Episode 54 of the Online Chicken School Podcast. Today we're talking about vaccinating for coccidiosis, and is the float test foolproof?
It's time for the Online Chicken School Podcast. Whether you've been keeping chickens for years or you're just fixing to get started, we'll help you get your schooling. And now, here's the chicken tenders, Don and Susie.
Hello, I'm Don, the big chicken tender.
And I'm Susie, the little chicken tender. If you're interested in backyard chickens, you're in the right place. It doesn't matter if you have a whole lot of chickens out in the country or just a few somewhere in the city. This is where we share our knowledge, experience, and opinions to help you get the most out of your backyard flock.
All right, we have a lot of information to talk about today, so I want to get right to the farm updates.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm afraid that this one is not going to make you fall in love with Don and Susie.
Yeah.
Because while some of you have already been out shoveling snow off your driveway this year, Susie was out picking cucumbers off our cucumber plant yesterday.
Yeah. It's been a pretty amazing garden so far. We in Florida here have two growing seasons. We plant in the spring and then we plant again in the fall. So we have tomato plants and we've got a couple varieties. We've got some new ones that we've never tried before. We've got San Marzanos. And when I was pruning the tomato plant the other day, it actually has hidden like 10 little tomatoes on that plant. So that was exciting. And then we've got some beefsteaks and two different varieties of cherry tomatoes. And there's a couple little tomatoes on those. We got some pepper plants. We already grew and harvested our radishes, which Don loved.
Yeah, those were really good, spicy, hot radishes.
Mm-hmm. Now, I don't care for radishes, so that was it was exciting to actually see something growing, but I didn't really get much out of it.
We've had a real love-hate relationship with the garden over the past years.
Mm-hmm.
When we first moved in, we said, oh, that's one of the big things on our list is plant a garden and have all our own veggies, and Susie's never going to have to buy another vegetable from the store again.
Yeah.
And that was a big fat failure. In a lot of ways, you know, I don't think we got anything out of that first garden at all.
No, I think I got maybe two tomatoes, and that was from the container garden that I did in the porch.
Then we took a little time off because we were so discouraged at how that first experience went. And last spring, we decided to try again and planted some beans and some radishes, and those actually turned out really well.
Mm-hmm.
So we decided to give it another big go this fall. The big surprise for me has been the cucumbers,
mm-hmm.
because, you know, they're kind of a scraggly looking plant. They just don't look very healthy to me.
Right.
But you look and you say, oh, there's not much there. But I don't understand. We're getting these giant cucumbers and I never see them growing. You just go out there and then bam, they're there.
Right. You like water the garden every day. And for 3 days, you're like, there's nothing. And then you go out the next day and there's this giant like 3-pound cucumber hanging right in your eye line. Like, where did that come from? So that's kind of nice. And even while we're recording now, we look out our side window and we can see all of our plants in our garden. And
you know, the thing for me is gardening and chickens go so well together,
mm-hmm.
that it's always bothered me that we can't make the gardening thing work because, you know, we actually are really good at the chickens.
Right.
We're such a failure at the gardening. And it's like those two are supposed to go together hand in hand. I mean, they're very symbiotic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've got the chicken poo is the best fertilizer you could find on the planet.
Right.
And we have enough chickens cranking it out that we would never have to buy fertilizer.
Right.
And then, of course, you know, the garden produces a lot of things. Like, for instance, you get the vegetables and you can toss some of the vegetables that maybe have worms or bugs you don't want to eat. You toss those to the chickens and they love them.
Yeah, it's a bonus when there's a worm in there.
But you don't even have to give them the fruit. I mean, they love just the plant materials of a lot of the veggies. You know, mm-hmm. you like pick all the beans and then you take the bean plants that are left over and you toss them in there and they go through them like crazy.
Now, of course, there are some things that they can't eat. I think it was last year when one of my tomato plants had just died. I was getting ready to pull it up and just throw it in the chicken coop. I went, you know, I better go check. And tomato plants are one that they cannot eat. They can have the tomatoes just fine, but not the plant. That's strange.
Yeah, so it's not across the board. You do have to sort of pick and choose and see which ones you can and which ones you can't use.
But anyway, it's encouraging to see that some things are growing. I don't have a complete black thumb. So hopefully every year it will get better.
Okay, so one last update I want to talk about before we move on is our little puppy Gordo, who's not so little anymore. What did he weigh in last time? 67 pounds?
67. It's hard to not see him as an adult. I keep like going, why aren't you learning this? Or why are you still doing this puppy behavior? You're huge. And I have to remember, he's only 5.5 months old. He is definitely still all puppy.
Yeah, he's physically bigger than Sadie.
Mm-hmm.
About the same weight, but physically he's bigger. And he's almost as big as Max now.
Oh, I can't believe it.
But he's like a six-month-old puppy.
In every way. Like, we'll come home, we'll go in the house to change our clothes, to go out to do, like, the 5 minutes of work we can get done before it gets really dark and all the mosquitoes come out. And in that 5 minutes, he has dragged, like, half of the things out of the garage onto the driveway in the grass.
Yeah, and you just can't stop it because he's just in that puppy phase.
Yeah, it is so frustrating. He loves your gloves for some reason.
I know.
I don't know what it is. We find them all over the yard.
Well, this week is Thanksgiving.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to be Gordo's first Thanksgiving.
Yes.
Not going to be his favorite.
It'll be one he wants to forget. And hopefully it's not one we want to forget. Gordo is going in on Tuesday for his procedure, getting his little snip done. So he's going to have to be confined for, I think they say, a week so that he doesn't tear his incision open. And oh gosh, I'm not looking forward to this.
We've been through this with Sadie, with Shep, and those just were not, they weren't terrible, but they are quite a disruption to your normal routine.
Mm-hmm, it is. And I planned it this way so that, you know, this is a short week for us work-wise. We work Monday. He has his surgery Tuesday afternoon. We work Wednesday, but then we're off Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. So I thought, well, he's going to be in the house so we can be near him and while he's recouping, but I don't know. That's going to be a lot of stress on everybody.
Well, and besides just being really big,
mm-hmm.
he is probably the most whiny dog we've ever had.
Oh my gosh. It's the hound in him, I think. I mean, we come home, we get out of the car, and he immediately starts whining and crying. It's like, what? We're here.
So I don't know what that's going to sound like when he's cooped up in the house for a week.
Oh, are we going to get any sleep? I have no idea.
Well, it's going to be two things. He's going to be dazed and confused. This isn't going to be his favorite Thanksgiving.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, by the end of it, he's going to be used to being in the house, and then he's going to get whiny all over again when it's time for him to go back outside.
Oh, it's going to be a treat. Maybe the next podcast is going to be interesting sounding. Either they're going to be exhausted and barely comprehensible, or we're just going to be so excited he's out.
So we'll see how that goes, but I don't think he's going to be looking forward to Thanksgiving next year.
No.
This is going to scar him for Thanksgiving.
Yes, I think so.
And now, the news. News. News.
Okay, so there's this chicken keeper in Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
And he's kind of getting ready to go to bed one night. And he hears some funny noises out in the chicken coop.
Well, first thing I would think is something's going after my chicken, some kind of predator.
Yeah, but he kind of starts to investigate and he realizes this isn't like a predator in the conventional sense.
Mm-hmm.
This is a predator of the two-legged variety, perhaps. There's a man out in his chicken coop.
Okay, so then I would think this guy is either trying to steal my chickens or he's trying to steal my eggs.
Yeah, so he does the logical thing and calls the police. The police show up and find this 23-year-old kid. I guess I'm getting old now that I call 23-year-olds kids.
Mm-hmm.
And this 23-year-old kid is laying among the chickens. When asked what he's doing there, he says, I'm trying to keep the chickens warm.
Oh, so he's a good Samaritan. He thought the chickens looked cold from the outside and wanted to go in and keep them warm. What a nice guy.
Now, you might be surprised by this. They say there may have been alcohol involved in the story.
I have no doubt about it. So what, this guy's just walking down the street and he's really cold because Oregon, and that this is what, last week?
Yeah.
So it's a little chilly and he sees a small house, which, you know, chicken coops sometimes look like a small house, and goes, sure. I'll bet that's warm in there. I think I'll crawl inside.
No, I believe he had good intentions. You know, he saw the chickens and I bet they're cold. I need to go in there and keep them warm.
Oh, what a nice guy then. He should have gotten an award. Did he get an award?
Well, if you call being arrested for second-degree burglary and second-degree trespassing an award, then yes.
I don't know. You know, obviously it was a mistake. It's probably something that he's going to regret forever anyway. I don't know if you have to arrest him. Who knows?
The way the article's written, it doesn't sound like he was actually in there trying to do damage. It just sounds like, yeah, he's really intoxicated, not making the best decisions.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently didn't do any damage to anything.
Right.
You know, it's like, okay, you just kind of take him, send him home and sleep it off.
Put him to bed. Pin a note to him. Tell him what happened.
I'm trying to imagine you go for a job somewhere and they say, have you ever been arrested before? You say, yes. Why? I was just out drinking one night and I was walking home and I saw a bunch of cold chickens. I just tried to keep them warm.
And they arrested me for it. Jeez. I don't know how cold it would have to get down here for me to climb in one of our coops, but it has to be a little bit colder than what it is right now, which is a beautiful 70 degrees.
Well, I tell you, they didn't have pictures of the property and chicken coop, but you know, I think some people might sort of bring this on themselves.
Really? Why?
You know, if you look at our chicken coops, it looks like a chicken coop.
Mm-hmm.
You can't really mistake it for anything else.
That's very true.
There's this sort of thing where people like to make their chicken coops look really decorative, like a little house.
Mm-hmm.
And especially if you have a big chicken coop, now it looks like a small or medium-sized house.
That's true.
And so, you know, the more house-like you make it, the more likely it is for someone to kind of mistake it for their house and walk in and...
That is true. Maybe he thought it was his house.
Yeah.
Maybe he lives in a very small, smelly house.
You would have been better off with that excuse of just like, hey, this looks exactly like my house.
And smells exactly like my house.
Now that I believe. Now, I don't personally know of the town of West Lynn, which is where this happened.
Mm-hmm.
But I imagine it's not a big city.
Probably not.
Because, you know, they really wanted to use this as an example to tell people that during the holidays, you need to really keep an eye out for activity like this. I'm like, wow, so this is big crime in West Lynn, huh?
I guess so. Lock your chicken coops, everyone.
In the big cities, you got people stealing all your Amazon packages and stuff off your doorstep for Christmas and breaking mm-hmm. into houses and stealing everybody's Christmas presents. And in West Lynn, big crime is someone tried to keep your chickens warm without your permission.
Very creepy.
It's time for the cooking segment. Or as I like to call it, what do you do with all them darned eggs? Here's Susie.
All right, now when we had our cold front come through last week, and by cold front, I mean when it went down to 80 degrees instead of the normal 90, it really got me in the mood for those fall comfort foods, you know? So I pulled out a recipe that I've made a couple of times in the past, and it's such a yummy, delicious comfort food that I thought I had to share it with everybody. And that is chicken and dumplings.
Yes, that's why I love this part of the year when the temperature suddenly drops 10 degrees or the freezing 80s.
Yes.
Susie starts pulling all the sweaters out and starts making food like chicken and dumplings.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's one of those comfort foods from when I was a kid. My mom would make it quite often, and she would take a whole chicken and chop it all down, throw it in the pressure cooker, get it all nice and cooked up, and then take the meat off the bones. And then, I mean, it would take her forever. She would make dumplings from scratch, you know, or I don't know, I've never made them from scratch, but I think it's like flour and water and something else, and drop them in the liquid. And I mean, it was a lot of work for her to make chicken dumplings.
Well, not being a cook myself,
mm-hmm.
it is one of those things that just has that appearance of being very time-consuming to make.
Right.
Not a lot of shortcuts that you can do and still have it taste right.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it kind of has fallen off the menu of many people because it just doesn't seem like there's a way for people who are really busy to make good chicken and dumplings.
Until now. I have found a slow cooker chicken and dumplings recipe. And like I said, I've made this a couple times. I even made it last night just to make sure like it's as good as I remember.
It's good.
Yeah. And it's got, are you ready for this? 5 ingredients. It is so easy. Now, it says to use chicken breasts. I think next time I make it, I'll use chicken thighs Maybe it won't get quite as dried out. Because when you put meat in a slow cooker, a lot of times the meat tastes dry, even though it's like in a ton of liquid. So I think the next time I do boneless, skinless chicken thighs. But anyway, here's the ingredients. Boneless, skinless chicken breasts, 2 cans of cream of chicken soup, 1 can of chicken broth, a medium onion, and large flaky refrigerator biscuits out of a can. I mean, it couldn't be easier. You take the first 4 ingredients, you pop them in the slow cooker, you put it either on high for 4 to 6 hours or on low for 8 hours. Then you cut up the biscuits while they're raw, you throw them on top, cover it again for about a half hour. You open that up, it looks just like my mom's chicken and dumplings.
Well, when you made this yesterday, I mean, would it take like 4 minutes for you to dump a bunch of stuff in the slow cooker?
Mm-hmm.
And then we headed out to do our errands for the day.
Right.
And then by the time we got home for the day, it was ready to go.
Yeah, I just had to put the biscuits in, you know, and they puffed up like little dumplings. And Don goes, isn't that going to taste like a biscuit? But it doesn't. I mean, it tastes like a just juicy dumpling. It was so good. Now, I put mine over egg noodles. I know a lot of people don't do that. Don thought that was weird the first time I did that.
I do like it, though.
Yeah.
I never had it that way growing up, but I do like it over the egg noodles. That's really good.
And now some people may say, oh, cream of chicken soup isn't the best thing for you. Okay. But you know what? When you're in a hurry and you got to get out the door for work that morning and you just need something quick and homemade and comforting, you cannot beat this. It is delicious. And one of the nice things I like, you don't even stir it. You literally dump the stuff in and it says, do not stir. And it all somehow comes together in this delicious, saucy, yummy, delicious chicken recipe. So we're going to post this on our Facebook page at facebook.com/onlinechickenschool and also in the show notes at onlinechickenschool.com/54. So if you want to see the recipe, make sure you head over there and you're going to want to try this.
Definitely give it a try one of these cold weekend afternoons. You will love it.
Well, you asked for it. Here it is.
Okay, well, we received a question from one of our listeners, Blair, and she listens to us with her daughter, Catherine, in Texas.
And she says, I am getting my first flock in January and I'm ordering 25 chicks from McMurray, and I was hoping you could help me with a question. They offer a vaccine for coccidiosis, and I'm wondering if there is any reason why I wouldn't want the chicks vaccinated. In a former pre-stay-at-home and homeschool 3 kids life, I worked in public health with infectious diseases, and the whole idea of developing tolerance through medicated feed makes me wonder if that isn't an overall dangerous trend towards developing resistant strains of coccidiosis. But I'm applying people medicine thinking here, so I know I may be off.
Well, Blair, thank you very much for that question, and I have to tell you, that is an interesting take. I don't think I've ever heard anybody address the, you know, medicated feed and coccidiosis vaccine from the angle of, is this going to create basically super coccidia that will be resistant to the drugs? And, you know, obviously this is a reflection of what we're seeing in the antibiotic community with animals and with people that, you know, we've been using antibiotics for everything for so long, just overusing antibiotics. Now we're starting to see these super bugs.
Right.
The concern is you go in to have any kind of surgery at all, even the most simple surgery. And the reason they can do any surgery at all is because we have antibiotics that will prevent you from getting a bacterial infection from some simple little surgery.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a really good question.
Yeah, this is one that made you think.
Well, let's start off with what we do. With the chicks that we hatch, we do not vaccinate for anything.
And it's not just because I'm cheap. I know some of you are thinking that. There are reasons.
Coccidia are little organisms that grow in the poop of really any animal. They're not limited to chickens.
Mm-hmm.
If you have poop laying around, coccidia will develop. It's not something that's like, oh, maybe it'll come by and become part of my flock. No, if you have poop laying around, which you do if you have chickens, coccidia will begin to grow in the poop. Now, it's not a really big problem in the fact that chickens will develop an immunity to coccidia so that it doesn't overwhelm and kill them. The problem is, it takes a little while for them to develop the immunity.
Mm-hmm.
And if the coccidia are allowed to sort of just grow out of control, it's very possible for them to take over the chick and kill the chick before it can develop that immunity.
Right.
So rather than vaccinate, what we do is just use a medicated feed, which is really easy to do if you have a backyard flock. It's readily available at any farm store. You can always find medicated starter or starter grower. And it's probably just the easiest thing for the backyard chicken keeper to do. Most hatcheries don't even offer the coccidia vaccine anymore. What they say is that it's just too easy to do the medicated feed, and it's easier on the chick. You know, with the vaccine, you're basically injecting them with several different types of coccidia, and there is a chance that they could have some ill effects. It won't kill them, but there is a possibility that they could get a little bit sick from it. And why put them through that when you can just use the medicated feed? And the way medicated feeds work is they use a drug that's kind of broadly labeled a coccidiostat. The goal is to just slow down the growth of the coccidia so that the chicks can develop that immunity before they die.
Mm-hmm. Kind of like when little kids, you know, you don't want their environment to be so super clean. You want them to eat a little bit of dirt. You want them to get exposure to some germs so that they can build up their immune system.
Yeah, it's why those kids in New York City that swam in the Hudson River, they don't get any diseases at all.
I know, you always bring those kids up. I've never met any of those children.
Well, of course, you only meet the ones that survived.
Well, that's true. We're not saying have your kids eat a lot of dirt.
No. But the bigger part of your question is, what about developing a drug-resistant coccidia? Because if that were to happen on a national scale, well, that would be a huge, huge problem for the poultry industry.
Oh, yeah, that'd be devastating.
Developing drug-resistant coccidia is definitely an issue, but it's not something that happens as quickly as you see with, you know, the antibiotics and that type of stuff. Because the way an antibiotic works is it doesn't slow down bacteria, it kills bacteria. So you wipe out all the bacteria except like one or two little buggers who are completely immune to that antibiotic. And the way most bacteria reproduce is by basically dividing themselves in two and making perfect little carbon copies of themselves. So if the original was immune to the antibiotic, then so is that little carbon copy that it makes of itself. It's kind of like Susie's favorite movie, Multiplicity.
That is one of my favorite movies. I find that so fascinating, and it's hilarious.
I don't get it.
Oh, come on. I like have to watch that every year.
It's a cute movie, but I don't get favorite out of that.
Well, you're just weird.
But anyway, so you know, you can imagine in a population, if you wipe out all the non-antibiotic resistant ones, and the only ones left to reproduce are antibiotic resistant ones, you can just imagine it's not too long before you have a population of nothing but these super bugs, as they call them.
Right.
Now let's look at coccidia. As I mentioned before, the drugs are not meant to kill coccidia, because if you wiped out all the coccidia, the bird does not have anything to go on to develop its immunity. You will have a few little coccidia that are immune to the coccidia stat. So basically the drug doesn't do anything to slow them down. But when it's all said and done, they're not going to be the only ones left standing. You still have all the ones that were slowed down by the coccidia stat. So now your population of bacteria is not 100% resistant. So you can develop the resistance in that population, but it takes a lot longer and a lot more generations than it does with, say, an antibiotic. It is still possible. It's not a non-issue. But this is something we see develop in the really large broiler industry, where you have one location, you know, so you're dealing with the same population of coccidia, and they're going generation after generation after generation, and they are developing thousands and thousands and thousands of birds. So you will start to see this in that environment. And what they have to do is sort of mix up the coccidia stat, you know, the type of medication that they're using, so that every once in a while you kind of change tactics a little bit and clean house. In the backyard environment, you just can't possibly develop enough chickens for that to become an issue. So mm-hmm. We've always used a medicated feed.
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't see any problems with going that route. Now, that being said, there's nothing wrong with doing the vaccine if you're going to order online from one of the companies like Murray that will offer the vaccine. Absolutely. Go ahead and do it if you prefer to do that. Just a few words of warning that if you have them vaccinated, and I forget, you know, they usually charge like a couple bucks extra. I don't know how much it is, but it's usually like a dollar or two per chick extra to have them vaccinated for something. If you do that and then you feed them medicated feed anyway, the medicated feed will destroy the vaccine.
Yeah, so you kind of paid all that money and you're flushing it down the toilet.
Yeah, because the vaccine, what it does is introduce a little bit of the coccidia to the bird. It really doesn't give them a coccidia stat. It gives them a little bit of coccidia so that they can start working on their immunity right away. The coccidia stat in the medicated feed will then kill the vaccination you just had injected into the birds for a dollar a piece.
Yeah.
So, you know, you may have spent $20-$30 and then you feed them some medicated feed and just wiped out that $20-$30.
Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like a one or the other, either vaccinate and then use unmedicated feed or don't vaccinate and use the medicated feed. Your choice.
Now, listen, if you got a couple Jacksons that you want to get rid of, send them our way. We'll take them.
That's right.
If you get the vaccine and you feed them the medicated feed, it's not going to hurt the bird. It's not like you're going to kill them or anything, but you are just going to waste that $20-$30 you spent on vaccines.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here's maybe one extreme example of where vaccines might come in handy. If you intend to feed your chicks solely fermented feed, the fermenting process will neutralize the coccidia stat that's in the medicated feeds. So you think you're giving your birds medicated feed, but if you ferment it and then give it to them, and that's all they're eating, well, now they're not getting any coccidia stat. So that might be one rare example. I don't know too many people who go that route, but if that's your thing, you might want to do the vaccine and then just ferment a non-medicated starter grower to feed your chicks. And that way they have the protection, but they also have the benefit of the fermented feed. You know, we've talked about this before. We do fermented feed, but it's almost more of a treat.
Right.
It's not a daily thing. And so they still are getting the plain old medicated feed and the protection that that gives them.
Mm-hmm. Now, we did say at the beginning of this conversation that we don't vaccinate the chicks that we hatch here for anything. But when we have ordered online in the past, we did put out the extra money for the Marek's disease vaccine.
Yeah, that's one of those ones that, you know, there's really no other way to give them protection against Marek's. And so when it is available, I do spring for that one.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if you want to spend a couple bucks extra somewhere, that's where I would put it.
Right, definitely. Because there really is no other way to, you know, give them that protection. And unfortunately, Marek's is not an uncommon thing. So I definitely think that's money well spent.
Well, Blair, I hope that answers your question. And congratulations on your upcoming flock.
And Catherine, we appreciate you listening as well. It's kind of cool when you can find something of common interest with your mom at that age. And I know when I was 13, there weren't a whole lot of things that my mom and I had in common. So that's pretty cool.
Okay, well, this week is Thanksgiving, which means we are very securely into the holiday season this year.
Yes, we are. And you know what's coming up is Black Friday.
So while you're making out that list of friends and family to buy gifts for, make sure you don't forget your good friends, Don and Susie.
Now, we aren't asking you to buy us any presents, but before you go to Amazon to buy stuff for everyone else, go to our website first at onlinechickenschool.com and click on the Amazon link over there.
It'll take you to the same Amazon site you know and love, and you pay exactly the same price for the things you buy, but Amazon will give us a little bit of a commission, and this helps us pay some of the podcasting bills. It really is the very best way to show Don and Susie some holiday love.
There they go again. More shameless self-promotion.
All right, for the main feature today, we're going to take a look at the float test and try and figure out, is it foolproof? And the reason we're talking about this today is because our good listener Dave in Pennsylvania sent us an email. And he says, I have a small flock. Eggs rarely last more than 3 weeks before consumption.
We're there with you there, Dave.
I collect eggs from nest boxes every day and keep them on the counter until I wash them, usually every day or two. I take each collected egg, gently scrub while running under warm water. I let them dry and put them in the refrigerator. I rotate my stock of eggs, making sure to use the oldest ones first. It never occurred to me that these eggs, handled this way, could go stale or bad. When I would hard boil a bunch of eggs, about 20% of them would float in the water. I've heard that floating eggs are stale or bad and should be discarded. So I've been cooking the floating eggs and feeding them back to the chickens. Looking in the Google machine, I found conflicting information about the float test and what it means. Maybe I can change the way I handle my eggs.
Well, after receiving that email, we did follow up with David to clarify whether the eggs were floating before, during, or kind of after the boiling process. Like when you put the eggs in to hard boil them, would some of them float to the top immediately, or did it take till they were boiling to float? And he confirmed that it was before. He would do the float test before he even started hard boiling.
Okay, so let's spend just a little bit of time talking about the float test and what it is and what it is not.
Mm-hmm.
The float test is a way of evaluating your eggs and to see whether you really should be eating them or not.
Mm-hmm.
And the way it works is you take some fresh, cold water and put it in a bowl that's taller than the eggs. And you put the eggs in, and you can, if you have a lot of time on your hands, you can do them one at a time, or like Susie puts like a whole batch in at once.
Mm-hmm.
And then you kind of take a look at how they rest in the water.
Right.
The very freshest eggs will be on the bottom of the pan, laying on their side. And then you'll notice some start to tip up a little bit, and some might even be standing on the bottom where they're perfectly upright, but they're still touching the bottom. And then others will be floating in the water. And the idea of the test is that the ones that are floating on the top are bad, and you should get rid of those ones, and all the rest you can eat. As long as they're touching the bottom in some fashion, they're okay to eat.
Mm-hmm.
That's the idea of the float test. Now, the reason the float test works is because part of the egg is a little air sac, so that if a baby chick starts to develop in there, it'll have some air to carry it through its development. And as the egg ages, it starts to purge moisture from inside the egg. You know, the shell is not exactly waterproof.
Mm-hmm.
So moisture tends to escape the egg, which starts to dry the egg out a little bit inside. And that air sac becomes a little bit bigger. And so a very fresh egg has the smallest air sac, and it'll sit on the bottom because there's just not enough air in there to pick one end of it up. So that's why the freshest ones lay flat on the bottom. But as that air sac starts to grow, which is, I mean, as little as like 3 days after it's laid, you'll notice it's starting to tip up a little bit. And then as it gets to like a week, it'll be, you know, more upright. And then it'll stand upright for weeks. You know, it only takes like maybe a week or a little bit longer for it to be standing perfectly vertical. And then the next step is for it to float. But that air sac has to become pretty big for it to actually lift that entire egg off the bottom of the bowl and for it to start floating. So if you think about it, nothing I described there has anything to do with the egg rotting.
Mm-hmm.
It only has to do with the size of the air sac in the egg.
Correct.
And we sort of have an idea of how fast that thing should develop. So really what the float test tells you is not whether the egg is rotten. It tells you roughly how old the egg is. It's a measure of the egg's age, not necessarily whether it's rotten or not. Now, I'm not saying that the float test is useless. We actually do the float test on all of our eggs.
That's right. When I think once a week I wash eggs now. It's on my new schedule. And, you know, we'll accumulate the eggs for the week in a basket on the counter. I will wash them, and then I do the float test immediately. And then I let them dry and put them in the fridge. Now, when I get a floater, I don't even take the chance of putting it in a carton, because then if I give that carton to the neighbor and I'm just not sure, I just don't like taking the chance. So any floaters I get, I actually just throw away, which is probably wasteful and people are probably mad at me now, but.
But it's sort of the safe way to tackle it.
Yeah, that's how I look at it.
But again, though, all those eggs you're throwing away, they're not necessarily rotten.
Mm-hmm.
All we know is the air sac inside the egg has grown large enough for it to become buoyant and rise to the top of the water. We don't know that it's rotten, and we don't even know for sure how old it is. we can sort of say that it takes most eggs this long for that to happen. But there are things that can cause it to happen a little faster in this egg. For instance, let's say that there's a couple little hairline cracks in that shell.
Right. That did actually happen a couple times in a row. And I was so surprised I called you over because I put like 5 or 6 eggs in the water and you see all these little streams of bubbles going to the top of the water. I'm like, what is that? And, you know, it was just cracks that we didn't see with our naked eye. But the second you put it in the water, they showed up.
Right. And, you know, it stands to reason that if you have larger pores, which a little micro crack would be bigger than the normal pores of the eggs, that there's going to be a faster moisture loss inside the egg, which causes it to dry out faster, which causes the air cell to grow faster. And now that one's going to float before the other ones that are a little more perfect would. So the point I'm trying to make is this. There is no digital timer on the outside of the egg that says, you know, okay, at exactly this date and time is when this one will start floating. It is a little bit of a variable. The purpose of the test is to say, for the most part, eggs will start floating when they reach a certain age. It's just kind of a handy rule of thumb to use when you're processing a lot of eggs and moving them through and you don't know exactly how old they are, how long have they been in the fridge. But again, they give you a good idea of the age, but they're not perfect to the age. And they really don't tell you anything about whether the egg is rotten.
Right. The only surefire way to tell if an egg is rotten is by using your nose. And it will be pretty darn clear from the smell whether it's rotten or not.
I mean, that's a hard smell to miss.
There is a reason why everything gross, people say, oh, smells like rotten eggs. I mean, because rotten eggs smell disgusting.
Yeah, it's a very distinct smell and it does get your attention.
Now, I have had some eggs that were floating and I would just throw them right down the disposal and they crack when they hit that blade. It has caused me to leave the room. It was so strong. And then you come back in and go, oh my gosh, now my house smells like rotten eggs. This is gross. That takes a little bit of work to get that smell out of your house. That's for sure.
Right. So if the egg floats, it could already be rotten.
Mm-hmm.
Like you said, you take it out, you throw it in the drain, and it breaks open, and you notice that, oh my gosh, that smells terrible.
Yeah, it's one of those things like, thank goodness I did this float test, because if I would have cracked that in a pan, I would have been really upset.
Well, and the thing is, you know, when you were doing that, when that happened, is when you weren't cleaning eggs on a weekly basis, you were cleaning them. I mean, sometimes there was a giant pile of eggs there before you actually got around, so some of those might have been pretty old.
Well, and it was the middle of summer, too.
Well, true. So greater heat means faster deterioration.
Mm-hmm. And there were times when, let's say it was raining when we got home from work, we didn't collect the eggs that day. And then the next day, it was the weekend and we were out. So we forgot to collect the eggs that day. So between the heat, the humidity, the length of time they stayed in the nesting box before they got in the house. Yeah, I think that contributed greatly to how many rotten eggs I had this summer. That's for sure.
Now, the thing is, as humans, we like to have a little buffer zone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I go out flying, every airplane has this very thick book on its limitations. You want to know, like, what's the maximum G-forces I can pull in this airplane before the wings rip off and then I fall out of the sky like a crowbar?
Yeah.
That's a good piece of information to have. But there's nothing magical about that number that's like, literally, once the G-meter hits that number, the wings are suddenly going to fall off.
Mm-hmm.
They've built in a little buffer there for people like me who like to push it just a little bit.
No.
Exactly. So it's like when you say, okay, I'm going to get to this number and then maybe I accidentally just go over just a little bit.
Oh, just a little.
You know, so they work in what we call in flying fudge factor.
Mm-hmm.
And they know that you kind of say, well, the real number of structural failure happens here. We're going to cut it back a little bit for those daredevil pilots.
Mm-hmm.
It's also kind of the way people look at driving the speed limit.
Right.
You know, yeah, it says 50, but we know that they're not going to write a ticket till 55.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that's true or not, we think that in our head.
Right.
Well, it's the same way with this. You know, the float test should have you tossing the egg before it gets to the point of actually rotting and smelling. Now, of course, like with Susie's example, it depends. If you leave it sit for 3 months on the counter and float test it, well, you missed the point when it started floating. You're way past that. You're to the rotting phase now.
Yeah, you're not going to use that egg, that's for sure.
Yeah. you know, we don't like the idea that, well, I want to know 10 seconds before it turns rotten. It's like, we like a bigger fudge factor in there that's like, I'll throw it away a couple days before it starts to rot.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you crack one open and you smell it and you go, oh, that one's definitely rotten. You crack another one open, and you say it's old, but you don't notice the smell.
Mm-hmm.
You don't always say, oh, that's a good one. You say, maybe I just can't smell the beginning stages of the rotting yet.
Right.
It freaks you out.
Yeah. I mean, I personally really like doing the float test because it tells me, should I take a chance on this egg or not? Most of the time when it's floating, I go for not.
Well, it's playing it safe,
yeah.
Which is not a bad idea.
Right. Especially with your health.
Yeah, right. Your health, the health of your spouse,
yeah,
your children.
You give yourself food poisoning, you will never, ever, ever eat another floating egg.
Well, the other thing is, if the way you judge whether an egg started rotting or not is cracking them all open,
mm-hmm.
once you find the rotten one, you're probably not going to feel like breakfast anymore.
Yeah, I think the last thing on my mind would be to eat an egg.
Yeah, once that's smelling up your kitchen, now you're just like, okay, no point in making the omelet because I'm not really in the mood for eggs anymore.
Which is kind of a good way, ladies, to get your husband to take you out to dinner. Find those rotten eggs, just tuck them away a little bit. And then when you want to go out one night, go, okay, I'll make dinner. And then you get that smell, go, oh, now we can't eat in this kitchen because it smells like rotten eggs.
So that's why you have all those eggs in the refrigerator marked with an X.
Just mind your business.
Like, just come in here and talk to me while I make you some eggs. Here, oh, I'm going to make you the best omelet you ever had. Oof, whoosh, what is that smell? Oh, I guess we better go out.
Yeah, you figured out my trick there. I have to come up with a new one now. Darn it. Podcast gets me in more trouble.
So Dave, in your email, when you say you take the ones that float and you cook those and feed them back to the chickens, I would put cash money on the fact that those weren't rotten.
Mm-hmm.
Because if they were, you would not be cooking them in your house.
And you'd definitely not want to give them to your chickens.
Yeah. So my feeling is they were probably fine.
Mm-hmm.
And it's up to you whether you'd want to take a chance eating them or not. But the way to really tell if they're rotten would be to crack them open.
Right. Now, I think his concern was he was getting a large number of floaters. He was getting like 20% of his eggs. And kind of want to know if that was normal.
Right. And the first thing I wonder is how many chickens do you have? Because if there's a recurring problem, I want to sort of narrow down, is it a flock-wide issue or is it a chicken issue?
Well, for example, this summer we had that one chicken, remember, that was actually laying rotten eggs.
I mean, oh, right.
We would go out there, collect the eggs, wash them right away, do the float test, and it's like floating. We're going... This was just laid today. What the heck is going on? And when I crack it open, you get that smell. So she was actually laying eggs that were already rotten.
So that really kind of blows the idea of this timeline that if it floats, it's exactly so many weeks old or that kind of mm-hmm. thing. Like literally it came out of the chicken floating and rotten.
Right. I did not like that chicken for very long. She was on my bad list, I'll tell you.
Well, it's not her fault because you say, oh my gosh, I didn't even know that was a possibility. Well, neither did we until all of a sudden it started happening. That kind of freaked us out.
Mm-hmm.
And what causes that, by the way, is a bacterial infection in the chicken.
Mm-hmm.
You know, your chicken has a bacterial infection and that gets passed onto the egg. So the egg is literally rotted before it's even out.
Well, and it's a good thing to know. You know, you want to know as quickly as you can when your chicken is sick. So we could have looked at that and went, oh, it's stinking chicken laying these rotten eggs. But it actually was a good thing because it gave us an indication that there is something wrong with this chicken that we need to get right on and fix.
And once that infection cleared up, she's back to laying normal eggs.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So that's why I wonder when you have 20% of your eggs that this is happening to, you know, if you have 5 or 6 chickens, suddenly that makes sense. You know, the mathematics makes sense that it's like one chicken is laying eggs that tend to lose moisture more quickly than normal. If you don't want to throw away eggs that are perfectly fine to eat, what you can do is take the ones that float and crack them open. You're not going to be able to hard boil them anymore, mm-hmm. but crack those open into like a little bowl. And if you can't find any bad egg smell, then it's fine to eat.
Now, one thing I would say is, don't just start cracking them all in one big bowl
right.
because what is it? One rotten egg will ruin the bunch. If all of them are fine except one and you crack that one in those bowl into that bowl, guess what? You're throwing that whole thing away. So I would individually crack them and then put them in a bowl and then crack the next one in a separate bowl, put it in with the other ones.
Wait a minute. So you mean if I got 20 good ones in a bowl and I crack a bad one in there, I can't just fish the last one out?
You can try, but you'll be the only one eating whatever you make with that. That's for sure.
So again, I'm not saying that's the way you have to go. I think we always err on the side of caution because we get a lot of eggs.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they float. We don't crack them open and go, oh, that one's still good. Save that one. You know, we just chuck it. It's the safest way to go. You're going to throw out some good eggs that way, though.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, you know, you can push the envelope and just do the smell test. That's the best way to tell if the egg is bad or not. Because I guarantee you, if the egg has any whiff of sulfur smell to it, it's definitely rotting. You yeah. don't want that egg. That's a guaranteed mm-hmm. test. Now, here's another thing I'd be curious about. Like, this whole situation makes me sort of want to experiment a little bit.
Mm-hmm. You do love that.
I do. I love a good experiment. One thing you might try is go out and collect a day's worth of eggs, wash them immediately, do the float test, and see if any of them are floating on day one. Because obviously that shouldn't happen normally.
Mm-hmm.
Now, assuming none of them float, put an X on those and put them in the refrigerator, and every 3 days, take them out and float test them again and see what's happening. You know, usually that first day, they should all be laying nice and flat on the bottom. On day three, they should start tipping up a little bit. On day six, they should be getting pretty close to upright. On day nine, they should be upright. And then, you know, they'll go for weeks like that and then eventually pop up to the surface. But from what you're describing, somewhere before 3 weeks, they're popping up to the surface because you said, you know, they never last that long in your house.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd be really curious if it was mine. Okay, when is it that this is happening? And that might give me a little clue as to what's going on. So that might be something I'd play with. I'd just be kind of curious as to when is this happening?
Mm-hmm.
And I guess if it came out of the chicken, you know, kind of the earlier it happens, if it's in like immediately or in the first week, then obviously someone is laying eggs that just aren't hanging onto moisture the way the other eggs are. And it might just be a peculiarity about that specific chicken.
Mm-hmm. One last thing before we wrap this up. You like to go to the let's experiment and being a detective and figuring out why things happen.
Right.
And I want to kind of switch gears and kind of go a little more naughty route with this. What do you do when you have a whole bunch of rotten eggs that you found?
Ah, going to the dark side.
Yeah. I mean, there's got to be uses for rotten eggs. So let's talk about some of those because you don't want to be wasteful. I mean, you know, what I'm doing by throwing them down to disposal, that's such a waste. They could be put to a good use.
Well, if there's one thing I learned about Native Americans from watching Dances with Wolves is use every part of the animal.
That's right. So rotten egg, we're going to give you a purpose for being. Let's go.
Well, okay, we live out in the country, but we're on a well-traveled road. And for some reason, I can't even think of a clean word to use.
Hooligans. Let's use hooligans.
Okay, the hooligans who drive around here, for some reason, they just love throwing all their garbage out the window as they drive down the street, and our fair share ends up in our ditch.
Mm-hmm, yeah, I'd like to really follow those people, follow them to their house, and if they live with their mother, which I assume they do, just yell at that mom and go, why didn't you teach this kid about not littering?
Yeah, but that's a good use for those eggs.
I think so.
If you got rotten eggs, I'd love to take a week off and just sit in the front yard, and as the cars go by when they throw something out, as they throw their styrofoam cup out, I throw three rotten eggs in.
Hey, you know what? It's the exchange. It's you want to give me something, now I want to give you something.
Now, I'm not going to suggest you should do that because it's one of those things that should just be unsaid. You should do that.
That's right.
People who throw stuff on the side of the road, yeah, they should have rotten eggs get tossed in their car as they go by at 60 miles an hour.
Oh, my goodness. You know,
nowhere on the planet. Now, I know we've gotten to such a sensitive society now that somehow, if you ever did that, you threw an egg in a car of someone who's throwing nuclear waste out their window, mm-hmm. they'll get a free pass and you'll go to jail for 5 years because you hurt their feelings.
Yeah.
But
totally,
you know,
worth it.
But we all know that's what should happen to those people.
Mm-hmm. So if you are one of those people, look out for flying eggs.
Yeah. Put a clothespin on the end of your nose because you might need it. Okay, well, on that note, as always, thank you for listening. If you like the show, consider going to iTunes and giving us a really nice rating over there. Also, make sure you tell a friend and get them listening.
And if you want to see the show notes for this episode, go to onlinechickenschool.com/54. Well, that's all for today. Talk to you next time.
You've been listening to the Online Chicken School Podcast. Look for us on the web at onlinechickenschool.com.